I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. Historian Georgi Kasianov is a professor at the Maria Curie Sklodowska University in Lublin, Poland. He's written, co-authored, and co-edited over 20 books on the history of his native Ukraine. He's an expert in memory studies and heads a laboratory of international memory studies. I had the chance to speak with him in February 2024 about his book, Memory Crash: The Politics of History in and Around Ukraine, 1980s to 2010s. Georgi's interest in the memory politics of Ukraine grew out of his own personal struggle to find ways to write critically about his country's past. He earned his doctorate at the end of the Soviet period and faced the harsh reality of state censorship. Even after Ukraine gained its independence in 1991, he realized that historians were still not free to write critically about the country's past. Instead, they found themselves bound to an older, narrowly defined ethno-nationalist history that they themselves had helped to revive and sanctify. As Ukraine fights for its survival in the present, Georgi Kasianov's work reminds us of the dangers of politicizing the past without any long-term plans for the future. Georgi, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Hello.
When I began my conversation with Georgi, he quickly reminded me that he began his career as an historian at a time when there was very little academic freedom.
I grew up in the Soviet Union. I grew up in mono-ideological system and mono-party system, when there was a Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which directed everything and which commanded everything, including the sphere of historical research. My first thesis was defended under the specialization of history of the USSR. Then my tutor, when I presented the final text of my dissertation, my tutor just deleted the names of Trotsky, Bukharin, Rykov, and some other Soviet top officials of 20s, just deleted them from my text. And when I asked him why, he told me, we should not tease the geese. So meaning the members of the scientific council, where I had to defend my dissertation, etc. So I did that. I did not resent it openly. That was a, let's say, very practical consideration, that you have written thesis, you have to defend it, etc. So, but it was a good lesson to me. It was in 1987. It was already perestroika and all other things, the glasnost and the, how people put it that time, fresh wind, etc. So, but nevertheless, in the academic field, it still was under control, and some people were unwanted on the pages of dissertation devoted to 20s and 30s.
Even at the very end of the Soviet Union, Georgi recalled that doing history, especially on Ukraine, required stealth tactics.
In 1990, I prepared a book on the history of Ukraine intelligence of 20s and 30s. And first, I did not steal documents, but I steal my notes from the archive, because making notes, I had to present the notebook to, I did, well, it was handwriting, so I just had to present it to my notebook with my notes to the to the person who was a director of the reading room. And then when I did it first time, she just used a, I don't know how to put it in English, she used a certain kind of ink to make complete pages of my notes, to make them black, so that just deleting all my part of my notes. So my next visit was with two notebooks, one for her and one for myself, which I used my clothes to hide it from her.
When the Soviet Union finally collapsed and Ukraine achieved independence in 1991, Georgi realized that doing critical analytical research on Ukraine was still not possible. As a historian working in a newly independent country, he found himself subject to a variety of pressures that constrained his academic freedom.
The situation changed, but the next actors came to the fore when it deals with the academic freedom. First of all, the street and what we call society or societal factors. So people wanted something. They wanted what they called this time to fill blank spots or to have a true history or to have a historical justice. So you had to follow this. So just imagine you're a historian. You're supposed to write a kind of analytical history, but you have to follow historical justice. What kind of analytical history it would be? Okay. Then another factor came. That was the factor of dominant discourse. I did not read Michel Foucault that time. I was not aware of post-structuralists about this time. But I felt this by my skin, probably, that there is something from outside which presses you, which somehow influences you. And I spent about 10 years to reach a level of freedom, of personal freedom, in terms of autonomy, let's say.
After struggling for years to attain his own academic freedom, Georgi found that by the 2000s, his country and fellow historians had come full circle. Once circumscribed by the dictates and narrative of the Soviet Union, they now had become prisoners of a new national narrative of their own making.
It is it's kind of irony of history that they created these prescriptions. They created dominant narrative. It was a kind of dynamics in this process. So in the end of 80s, many historians changed from, they moved from, let's say, communist ideology to national or nationalist ideology. The idea of history, not as a history of struggle of classes, but a history of struggle of nations for self-determination. So within this paradigm, they reconsidered the history of Ukraine and created a kind of canonical narrative, ethnocentric narrative, history of Ukraine as a history of Ukrainians, and then creating its narrative or recreating, because it was created 100 years before, so then started to follow it and started to perceive this narrative as a kind of source of wisdom. And then accepting this and recognizing this as a source of wisdom, they started to follow it uncritically. And then, certain aspects, this narrative became a kind of sacral text, so sacred text. So those who deviated from the prescriptions of these canonic narratives were considered as dissidents and as a revisionist or whatever.
So I might jump ahead a little bit here because you're talking about this narrative that these historians are helping to write, and then they're caught up in it themselves. And Ukraine is a new country. I mean, it needs a national story. It needs to find ways to connect people to offer a sense of belonging and identity. So, and historians play a role in that.
Absolutely.
But what I thought was fascinating reading your book was that you point out that it's not something that's created. It's something that's restored. It's a restoration project. And I think you describe this history that's written as something that's taken from a totally different era and just parachuted into the present. That it's a story that comes from the time of horse and carriages, and then it's plunged into the era of automobiles. So what is this narrative? They don't invent it. They dust it off, right? And bring it into the present.
Well, it's classical story. It is classical story of the era of nationalism. So whether your state exists as a project or as a reality. Of course, this state and this nation need a kind of historical biography. That's a kind of canon of the development of nation state. So it happened not only in Ukraine, it's everywhere. Probably with the exception of Russia, where there was not national narrative, but was imperial or neo-imperial narrative, because Russia constitutes itself as an empire, not as a national state. But everywhere in Central Eastern Europe, in Balkans, in Baltic states, everywhere there was a renaissance of ethno-national narrative. And this renaissance was followed, of course, by the return to the roots. And Ukraine had these roots. Ukraine had a 100, even more than 100 years, historiographer tradition, which was founded by Mikhail Hrushevsky, who in 1904 wrote an article which was exactly about separating the history of Ukraine from imperial history of Russia, and exactly about separating history of Ukraine as a history of Ukrainian people. It was populist narrative. It was about Ukrainian people, which was identical. The term Ukrainian people was identical to Ukrainian nation, and Ukrainian people to the other side was identical to Ukrainian peasantry mostly. So people, mostly peasantry and intelligentsia. So summarizing this, that was a return to the roots. You can find monographs. For instance, there was collective monograph, History of Ukraine, New Vision, published in 96, republished in 97, republished in 2000, republished in 2000 in 2002, New Vision. But at the preface to this book, the editor-in-chief wrote that this book is new, but it is based on 100 years historical tradition started by Mikhail Hrushevsky. So Mikhail Hrushevsky wrote his article and his 10 volumes, History of Ukraine Rus, at the turn of 20th century. So that was the time when Ukraine didn't have a state, Ukrainians didn't have state. The state was only in the projection, in the future, as a political project. And the nation also was in the process of formation. So historians were nation builders. And in the 90s, they got back to this role as nation builders. Now there was Ukrainian state. Now there was Ukrainian nation, which is a community of those of the citizens of the state. Majority of them were Ukrainians, about 80%. So they needed their biography. And historians follow this scenario. Since they already have this historiographical tradition, they just got back to this tradition. The only problem with this tradition was that this tradition was founded in the time of when Ukrainian nation was at the beginning of modernization process. But this narrative returned to Ukraine when Ukrainian nation was modern nation, with a nation which produced space shuttles, aircrafts, produced super technologies, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a modern nation, but this modern nation had, with its history, had to go back to its historical narrative invented 100 years before. In the core, this narrative was, well, but it's okay, no problem. But the major problem was that at this time, Ukrainian nation was not just ethnic nation, it was civic nation. It was the community of citizens, not just community of blood or language or culture. There were also other, let's say about 22% of other ethnic groups in the territory of Ukraine in 1991. they also might have their own visions of history, and these visions were not taken into account. So the whole process was presented as a being of ethnic Ukrainians through the centuries, and the so-called others from capital O were somewhere. They were not aboard. They were somewhere else, not in this. Or, in the worst case, they were considered as aliens.
So do you see that as a missed opportunity, that you have a chance to rewrite the national story, to connect people to the nation in new ways? The country has changed significantly since the last, what, brief period of independence in the early 20th century. And you go back and recycle a 100-year-old narrative that leaves a lot of people out of the story. I mean, I can't. When I was reading this, I'm somebody who works on immigration in France and Algerians in particular, and I've read a number of books written by the children of immigrant workers who grew up in France in the 1960s and 1970s. And there's one author who talks about going into school and reading the history book about and reciting how his ancestors were the ancient Gauls. And, you know, and the whole point is just to poke fun at how you have this narrative that maybe made sense at the end of the 19th century when they were setting up the school system. But when he's in class in the 1960s or 70s, it's completely out of sync with the new reality of the country. And you know, his family's there because they're helping to modernize the country. They don't have the labor to do it on their own. But he's alienated from that national story. I couldn't help thinking about that when you made this point about the story from the era of horse and carriages.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, it's my point. And France is a very good example. You propose people from Algeria to be Gaulois, and then you might have a problem with the national identity. So generally, it's funny that France presented as a canonical story of civic nationalism. So égalité, fraternité, and so on. And then France did, extreme efforts to kill local languages, like in Provence or in Bretagne, and this book, Eugène Weber book,
Peasants from Frenchmen, yeah.
From peasant to Frenchman. Yeah, so they used a good deal of coercion in that. And then it's this country presented as a kind of cradle of democracy and civic nationalism. That's a kind of irony here. So, and here the same story. You have 22% at 91, you had 22% of other ethnic groups in your country. And then you propose them to learn history where only Ukrainians presented. And if they presented or misrepresented, sometimes presented or misrepresented in a very specific way. So that was, I agree with this, and this is my point, that it was a missed opportunity. And now we can get into the swamps of nation and nationalism theories and try to understand what kind of project was proposed by Ukraine in terms of nation building. And I tend to call it nation state building project, not state nation, but nation state building project. And that was probably one of strategical mistakes. The only thing which saved Ukraine for a while was that this nation state project was quite ambiguous, and it provided a lot of space for other different ethnic groups to coexist there. For instance, linguistic Ukrainization was quite superficial, and about 60% of population used Russian, or even top officials speaking Ukrainian in public just switched to Russian in private life, et cetera, et cetera. Then, the idea of a homogeneous Ukrainian nation based on only Ukrainians, ethnic Ukrainians. Also, ethnic Ukrainians is also interesting story because there are ethnic Ukrainians in Transcarpathia, ethnic Ukrainians in Bukovina, ethnic Ukrainians in the south. They are very different. They are ethnic Ukrainians, but they, in many cases, culturally very different. So that that was a exactly a nation-building project on the principles of 19th century. But Ukraine started its existence as an independent state in the end of 2020 and in 21st century. And of course, there should be kind of combination and, let's say, balance between principles of ethnic and civic nationalism to build a prosperous state. Unfortunately, it was not taken into account. Formally, Ukraine was and still is a, in the constitution, there is a notion of the people of Ukraine, which is exactly a notion of civic nationalism. Ukrainians are those who are living in Ukraine and have Ukrainian citizenship, regardless of their ethnicity. However, in practice and in many policies, there were principles of ethnic nationalism applied massively, sometimes with more or less intensity, but it was the case. And so that probably the history textbooks were the best reflection of this process. I worked at Source Foundation for 13 years as education program director, and we did a lot of projects involving civil society teachers to change the context of the history textbooks. And to a certain extent, there was a moderate success. In the course of time, part of, I would say the good deal of, intolerant notions, mentions, a good deal of intolerance, cultural intolerance, diminished. And the Ukrainian textbooks became more sensitive to multi-perspectivity and multi-ethnic composition of Ukraine. However, unfortunately, after 2014, after the Russia's aggression started, then this tendency stopped.
Yeah, and that really reminds me of my... I had an episode where I looked at... memory activists in Israel, and they're basically trying to broaden the national story to include, well, what happens to Palestinians who lived in Israel in 1948? To what extent has the Nakba been forgotten? And the whole point of the author is that it's really hard to broaden the story if you're in a context of war.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Yes, it's true. Yes, this is a kind of dynamics after 2014 when first of all, Russia led, memory wars against Ukraine for about 5 or 7 years. And under the slogan of the fight against nationalism. And the specifics of this memory wars was that Russia did not consider Ukraine and Ukrainian politics and Ukrainian vector of politics did not consider them as an external politics or as a foreign politics. They believed that politics in Ukraine is a matter of their internal politics. And then struggling against Ukrainian nationalism, they believed that they do this on their historical territories, on their historical proper. And in return, it became a kind of impulse for the further development of extreme Ukrainian nationalism, particularly in terms of anti-Russianism. So Russia wanted to dominate and to command Ukrainian historians. In return, Russia received a development of nationalism in Ukraine and anti-Russian nationalism, particularly after 2014. the fact that representatives of radical Ukrainian nationalists took over the major memory politics institution in Ukraine is exactly a result of Russian aggression, direct result of Russian aggression. And the mobilization of Ukrainians, of certain part of Ukrainians, under anti-Russian slogans, exactly the direct consequence of Russia's aggression 2014. So it's a kind of vicious circle. Russia struggles against Ukrainian nationalism. Ukrainian nationalism is growing. Russia struggles against growing Ukrainian nationalism. In response, Ukrainian nationalism is growing. So it's endless story.
Well, one of the things I want to go back to, because there are these two narratives. On the one hand, you've got a country that goes back to the 19th, early 20th century to look for its past, for a usable past. On the other hand, you've got this reality of lots of different narratives of belonging within Ukraine. And the two that you feature in your book, feature most prominently, are this the national that veers in the direction of nationalism. And then you have the Soviet nostalgic narrative, and they're really at odds and increasingly in tension in the course of the 2000s until that Soviet nostalgic narrative gets completely, for the most part, displaced. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are those two narratives that are in tension? How do they coexist, and when do they start to really be at loggerheads?
Well, generally, they started, the first stage was in the end of 80s and beginning of 90s. And that time, there were Soviet narratives, not Soviet nostalgic narratives. The Soviet narrative, which tried to, let's say, reorganize the history of Ukraine along communist ideology, but without extremes of this ideology. During 90s and 2000s, the Soviet narrative turned into Soviet nostalgic narrative, particularly in 90s, when the social economic situation was extremely bad and people started to recall recent Soviet future without economical crisis, without jobless people, without homeless people on the streets, without galloping prices, et cetera, et cetera.
Is that like a kind of nostalgia that it's...
Yes, exactly. Like nostalgia in Eastern Germany, exactly. The same was in Poland, in Czech Republic, and in many Central East European countries, in Baltic states. So and that was a Soviet nostalgic narrative. And they coexisted, the national narrative and Soviet nostalgia coexisted in a while. It was a kind of, some commentators called this ambivalent politics of history. In fact, there was no, let's say, well-formulated politics of history in the 90s. It was really, yes, it was ambivalent to a great extent. And I think that the open conflict started in the middle of the 2000s. When representatives of Soviet nostalgic narrative, I mean politicians, mnemonic actors, started to instrumentalize it, activists instrumentalize it. And at the same time, politics from other camp, from national Democrats and populists and nationalists, started to instrumentalize their narrative. And then it led to the open clash between these narratives. These two narratives, including street fights, including things which happened in Kyiv in 2005, and later, including marches devoted to Bandera in Kyiv started in 2008, and so on. So, I think that the radicalization of the conflict between these two narratives. Narratives started at the time when politicians got the idea of the potential of this narrative, of instrumentalization of these narratives. They started to use it in active politics. And this, naturally led to what happened when they started to confront publicly these narratives. And then due to the fact that these narratives were located regionally. For instance, Soviet nostalgic was predominant in the south and in the east in Donbas and particularly in Crimea, while national or nationalist narratives were predominant in Western Ukraine and in Central Ukraine. So that was also extremely dangerous in terms of instrumentalization.
And you mentioned too that their interests at play, right? There are economic industrialists in the eastern part of Ukraine that they see the promotion of this Soviet nostalgic narrative in their interest. There's this party of regions.
Yes.
There's power politics and economic interests that are behind this. There may be a real residue of longing for at least an imagined past, but then there are groups that seize that and exploit it to promote their own interests.
It was, to a great extent, it was deceptive and self-deceptive for those who promoted it, because they definitely use it from purely instrumentalist reasons. I don't believe that. Can you believe that super capitalists, the tycoons who take added value from industry, that they could be a Soviet-minded people, that they would, because communism did not recognize private property, but they were big private property owners, and they would promote communist ideology. It's hardly believable. So they just used it for purely instrumentalist aims to get a loyalty of their electorate, of the people on these territories, telling them that the sweet story about Soviet times, when in fact these people, workers in Donbas, for instance, mine workers, were a privileged class in Soviet society. They got the biggest salaries. They got huge social benefits, et cetera, et cetera. So there were sweet Soviet times in this region, and these sweet Soviet times were a part of this Soviet nostalgic narrative.
So they had a receptive audience for that story.
Exactly. And they use it quite effectively. Not being communists, so they used communist times nostalgia for capitalist purposes, which is really a great irony of history. Of course, there were also communists who used this for their own purposes, but it's also funny that the Ukrainian Communist Party was funded permanently by Ukrainian tycoons, including the Party of Regions.
My sense is that there are certain political events that happened, whether it's the Orange Revolution, especially the Revolution of Dignity and the Maidan Revolution 2014, that tipped the scales, right? And pushed this process of the nationalist narrative into high gear and really force a process of decommunization that really hadn't, it seemed like maybe the East hadn't really been forced into a national mold up until that point in time. And that really goes into high gear. I know there's this period of, you describe as the Lenin fall. And I realized that the icon for this podcast really comes from that particular period of time. It's the statue of Lenin in Kharkiv that's being toppled, pulled down with ropes in 2014. That's the image that I use for the logo for this podcast. But that's a particular moment in time. And could you provide an idea of what scale does this take on, this process of decommunization, in terms of statues and street names and the extent to which, how far does this go?
Yeah, it was a great imitation of decommunization. By the time when this massive decommunization started in 2015, to a great extent, I do not have statistics, but we had we did a field research in 2010 and 2012. With my graduate students, and one of them even wrote a book about this later, about Lenin statues in central Ukraine. So what she did, she visited the big cities, city centers in central Ukraine, like Zhytomyr or Vinnytsia or Khmelnytsky, etc. And she stood next to Lenin monuments there, and she asked people on the street, "Who is this?" Then we also make questionnaires for the students in big universities in these cities, for historians, students of history, the first year students and fifth year students. And then the major task was to find out what people know about Lenin and what they think about Lenin. So majority of young people knew about Lenin very few. Moreover, what is interesting, that people who were asking the streets sometimes had real problems to explain who is this. Well, they could read the sign on the under the statue and say, it's Lenin. And who is Lenin and what he did, and et cetera, et cetera. So many people, particularly young people, were not aware of it altogether. So when Svoboda Party and ultranationalists started their crusade against Lenin, that was very manipulative maneuver, because they they recovered the ghost of communism. So there was no communism anymore. There was no communist. There was no communist threat anymore at this time. Communist Party of Ukraine did have very few chances even to reach parliament by party lists. So there was no communist threat like it was probably in the 90s, restoration of communism. So that was very speculative. And they use it for certain political purposes, for political mobilization, et cetera, et cetera. So, and Lenin Apart or Lenin Fall in 2014, so-called spontaneous. It was not spontaneous. It was a part, you know, just immediately in hundreds of towns, people started to topple Lenin statues. Of course, they imitate, or of course they follow the examples, et cetera, but everywhere there was an organized group of people who did what they did and did very well. So it was a political project.
One of the other observations you make that jumped out at me was that if you're looking at this crafting of these different narratives or the writing of a national history, is that a lot of it seems to be done just on the fly. It's not planned out. It's I think you mentioned that these things can happen within a normal mode or in a crisis mode, and that
yes,
in the case of Ukraine, that these stories that what's being remembered, commemorated, it's often happening within a crisis context, and the consequences, the implications, are not really being thought through. It's a somewhat of a chaotic process.
Exactly. It's to a great extent, it's a spontaneous process. And so there might be different kinds of logics behind this process. For instance, you can, if you have nation state, new nation state, as you mentioned it before, then you need certain kind of ideology for this state and certain kind of central idea and biography of this state. So then you follow a traditional scenario of nation state. Okay. So you start to write a biography of nation, of titular nation of this Ukraine, like in case of the country, like in case of Ukraine. Okay. So then you have interest groups in the society who promote certain kind of narrative for their own political purposes, like it was with this conflict between communist Soviet nostalgic and nationalist narratives. Okay, this is instrumentalization. And if you follow the logics of their actions of promoters or memory warriors, then you would see that in many cases, their actions were responsive. There was not planned strategy behind this. So, for instance, elections. Then you use Party of Regions and Communists use the thesis about nationalism threat and start bombing the nationalist narrative or national narrative. Rather nationalist than national, because nationalist, it is, well, generally the word nationalist in Ukrainian was pejorative for a long time. So in response, the politicians from National Democrats or populists or nationalists starting to promote their version of the past exactly for political purposes. So not because they planned this long year sometime before, but in response to the actions of their opponents. And exactly the same in the state policies. Yushchenko came to power. And since the beginning of the 2000s, he was very much preoccupied with the Great Famine. And as a president, he did his best to promote the Great Famine and Holodomor as a central element of politics of history of his time. And then there was a response from his opponents from different camps to oppose this tendency. And this is, I think that the lack of strategy and the lack of calculation of consequences is a kind of birthmark of Ukrainian politics for all 30 years of existence of Ukraine. No strategical thinking among power holders and among competitors for power. Just short-term tasks and no calculation of risks, no calculations of risk analysis.
One of my earlier episodes, I interviewed this Todd Nelson on how Stalin gets rehabilitated, and you basically you harness Stalin to the story of the success in the Second World War, and you use that to forget about the repressions.
Yeah,
basically, and this was when I was interviewing Todd Nelson, it was just as Russian forces were gathering on the borders of Ukraine, and he was warning that this story, now told in schools, was part of a process of militarizing Russia, this over celebration of the Great Patriotic War. So the stories that you invent, the stories that you tell, become part of the national psyche. And I just wonder, in the case of Ukraine, are you concerned about the direction that the country's gone, and if you have missed opportunities to tell the story in a different way, if you have a really exclusive story that leaves out a lot of people, emphasizes victimization, maybe adds on some heroic stories later on, but isn't really in sync with Ukraine of the 21st century. If that's the mold that people are being forced into, is there a concern? Do you have concerns looking to the future of your country?
Well, generally, it can be placed into the context of future itself, not just future of historical narrative or future of immediate future. This future is unclear, so we don't know how Ukraine would look in the next year or two years or even 5 years. So ask president of Ukraine, how would you expect Ukraine would look in 2029 or 2030? So that's, again, I'm going back to the lack of strategical thinking of our elites. However, if we'll take into account the the dynamics, look what's going on with Ukraine now, what territories lost at this moment, what territories occupied, it's mostly Russian-speaking territories. It's territories where majority of Russian-speaking population and Russian population was concentrated. Okay? Now these territories depopulated. So many people migrated either to Russia or to the Ukrainian territories, which controlled by Ukrainian government, or to the West. And what is really dangerous at this moment is that, let's say, visually, Ukraine becoming more homogeneous in ethnic terms, because a lot of Russian-speaking population lost together with territories, which means that Russian speakers and Russian minority become real minority. Moreover, if you look at the policies of last 2 years about Russian language, about Russian books, about Russian cultures, et cetera, you will see that the concentrated efforts to press out every features of Russian culture from Ukraine. But the problem here is not the Russian culture itself, but the Russian population, the remains of Russian population or Russian-speaking populations who are considered sometimes or presented as pro-Putin part of population, which is not true. And this is very dangerous because it is exactly about the intolerance, about the discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. So that, and this also might be reflected and already reflected in the national, in the historical narrative. If you look at the changes with the Ukrainian textbooks, you might see that, well, if Russia presented there as an eternal oppressor, well, it's okay. It's, well, it is determined by the Russian aggression. Russia did its best to make Ukrainians anti-Russian. But Ukraine has Russian population and Russian speakers within the country. Those who are absolutely loyal to Ukraine, those who fight for Ukraine in the on the front lines. And then contemporary politics does its best, or probably worst, to push them out, to suppress them, to make them unloyal to Ukrainian state. And this is extremely dangerous. And this is unacceptable. Unfortunately, it takes place. And I know that many Russians feel themselves, let's say, not in much comfortable position. Because from one side, there is Putin who is bombing the Russian-speaking territories. And from the other side, there are some kind of hyperactive activists, nationalists, etc., who blame Ukrainian Russians in being a kind of collaborators or whatever, just because they speak Russian, just because they want to read Tolstoy, just because they don't want to give up their language and their culture.
Georgi Kasianov, thank you so much for taking time to speak to me today. I really appreciate it, especially during your evening.
No problem.
Historian Georgi Kasianov is a professor at the Maria Curie Skłodowska University in Lublin, Poland. He's the author, co-author, and co-editor of over 20 books on the history of his native country of Ukraine. I've been speaking with him today about his book, Memory Crash: The Politics of History in and Around Ukraine, 1980s to 2010s. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.